Welcome to my house. I'm delighted you could come. I'm certain you will find your stay here most illuminating. May you find the answer that you seek. It is here, I promise you.
Welcome to Now Playing's bonus movie review of The Legend of Hell House.
This house, it knows we're here.
A Podbean backer review chosen by Jason Fisher.
I was the only one to make it out of here alive and sane in 1953. And I will be the only one to make it out of here alive and sane this time.
Hosted by Stuart.
My people tell me you're one of the best five in your field.
Marjorie.
My people tell me she's the best in her field, too.
And Arnie.
Between the three of you, I expect an answer within a week.
This podcast will contain detailed plot spoilers and harsh language.
It's just that I'm concerned for you coming into this pest hole.
Listener discretion is advised.
If I leave Hell House now, my whole life is going to be a failure.
Can't solve it. It cannot be solved. You're gonna die.
Today, we're discussing The Legend of Hell House, starring Pamela Franklin, Roddy McDowell, Clive Revel, directed by John Howe. This is Arnie, co-host of Now Playing, and you're the one who should leave this podcast. You're the one who's being used, not me.
This is Stuart.
And this is Marjorie.
The legendary Marjorie. She's back.
I am back because it's horror, guys. You know that's my favorite. I'm a horologist.
Haunted houses. Now, you've been on the fence on that. I thought you loved them because you love poltergeists, but then in later talks, you were actually saying you don't like to watch them because they scare you.
Occasionally, yes. If they are really well done, they will give me the heebie-jeebies, and I do believe in otherworldly spirits versus, you know, a made-up mythical monster, you know, like Leprechaun.
Sure.
That's not real, and that's not going to scare me. But Poltergeist had a very lasting effect. I grew up with a father who was in the funeral industry, so I heard a lot of ghost stories.
Yes, all of this stuff. You've talked about this. I think what's cool about this movie is this is a movie that's going to say there's a science behind all of that. There's physics. There's reasons why we think things are haunted. We're not crazy for thinking that things are going bump in the night that we cannot see.
It was interesting to me because I haven't seen a lot of the classic haunted house films, ghost films. I mean, I've never seen any of the Amityville films. So to me, it all started with Poltergeist. So you mentioned the science behind this. Now at least I know when the scientists in Poltergeist come in and set up equipment, what kind of cinematic history they're referencing. And I know this thanks to Jason Fisher. Jason is one of our Podbean backers who stepped up his level for 1 month thanks to his wife, I believe. I think this was a gift from her, as I understand it, and got to pick one of the movies for us to review. And he wanted this, Roddy McDowell's Legend of Hell House.
Well, Roddy McDowell was billed as the star here in America, but over in England, it was actually Pamela Franklin who was the big get. She had just starred in The Prime of Miss Jean Brodie, a drama that had put her on the lips of everyone in the UK, and they thought she was going to be the next big thing. So depending on who you ask, this is either a PG-rated Roddy McDowell horror film, Peter Vincent before he was Peter Vincent, or, yeah, this is a legendary British horror movie, I think ranked as one of the 10 best in a recent poll.
Had you seen it before then?
I have. I knew this movie from childhood. I mean, there was a time when I was, if it was on television and it was listed as horror, I was staying up to watch it. This was during the days of, I'd say, 7th, 8th grade, where I would literally stay up till 4 or 5 in the morning and just watch cable programming, and this was on. And I remember being 3 o'clock in the morning, being really creeped out by it. I always thought this was a scary movie, but I never saw it again.
Marjorie, you've seen this?
I have not seen this. You know, I think I've heard of it and maybe seen it at the video store when I'd perused the horror movies looking for something good when I was not old enough to rent these movies. It sounds familiar, The Legend of Hell House, but I have never seen it.
I'm right there with you. When I saw the poster, that image of the one-eyed skull above a mansion, I've seen that poster, either at the horror cons we go to or at a video store or somewhere. That was in my memory, but I've never seen a frame of this film until for this review.
Yeah, you may not know the legend of The Legend of Hell House, but you do know the legend at this point of Richard Matheson, who is, maybe he doesn't have the renown of a Edgar Allan Poe or Stephen King or H.P. Lovecraft, but I think people in the horror literature genre consider him to be one of the great writers of horror fiction. He had a storied career working in television and film, and we've covered him twice. Once, I thought it went pretty well with Steven Spielberg's first movie, Duel. He wrote the source novel. And then, yeah, it turns out he wrote the script for Jaws 3D, which I won't hold against him.
And he wrote an episode of Star Trek, I looked up, and some other movies.
Yeah, he's done a lot of landmark works, from Incredible Shrinking Man, a 50s campy movie, to Karen Black getting chased around by the Tiki Doll in Trilogy of Terror, Christopher Reeve's romance with Jane Seymour, Somewhere in Time, people love that movie. I Am Legend, it was filmed 3 times, most recently with Will Smith, that's his novel.
And that's what I most think of him as, is that book, that story, that's where I hear his name the most.
Yeah, the Twilight Zone years, too. He wrote a lot of landmark episodes of Twilight Zone, including the one with Shatner looking out the plane window and seeing the gremlin on the wing.
That's a good one.
Yeah, they put it in the Twilight Zone movie for a reason. It is a classic. Real Steel, the Hugh Jackman movie, Stir of Echoes, The Box with Cameron Diaz.
That one sucked.
Oh, yeah. No one should hold that against Richard Matheson. But What Dreams May Come may be my least favorite adaptation that I've seen. But
it's better than The Box.
Arguably. I don't know.
And I think it's better than Stir of Echoes. I saw that one, too.
Yeah. The movies haven't always gone great. But again, a real legend in the genre. And this is probably his most legendary book. I went and I read it. Now, I assume if you didn't know the movie, you hadn't read the book, Hell House, but it was written in 1971, about 2 years before this movie was made.
Connect me with the history of this, because we discussed with Conjuring books about how those are supposedly based on real events, and the Amityville is supposedly based on real events. Was this known to be a work of fiction, and where did it come in the point of The Exorcist and the stories of haunted houses here in the States?
It has no foundation in truth. Richard Matheson has never said that any of this is based on anything other than Shirley Jackson's The Haunting of Hill House. It is a reference to probably the most famous haunted house story of all time. Don't know if you've read that. I've never read the book, but I certainly know the 1963 movie, Robert Wise's The Haunting. It's a great film. And that had been out for about a decade when Richard Matheson wrote this. He saw the movie, saw things about it, said, I want to do this, but I'm going to respond to some of the things that Shirley Jackson is positing with her story. And so this movie is a reaction to a classic haunted house story, but it is not based on a real in air quotes, or otherwise haunted house.
I saw the remake of The Haunting with Liam Neeson, so I'll say that counts.
Well, they'll say one thing, that the filmmakers of this movie claim that that remake stole all their art direction, so that if you watch that expensive remake, you're seeing their sets rebuilt by Hollywood. I don't know. I didn't go back to look and verify, but that's what they claim. And don't get it confused with the Vincent Price movie that has a very similar name as well, that's called The House on Haunted Hill. That came out around the same time as The Haunting. It was also remade very badly and has nothing to do with either Shirley Jackson's novel or Richard Matheson's novel. Now, Hell House is about a house in which it's going to assert unequivocally the supernatural exists. The thing is, when you read Haunting of Hill House or see The Haunting, there's a lot of psychological subtext. Maybe it's all in the character's head. Maybe there was no ghost. And Richard Matheson said, fuck that. I'm going to tell a story in which the investigators are proven. They think that it all can be explained away by science, but it's going to blow up in their face. And so that's the intent of why he wrote Hell House. And I think it was a real inspiration. I know Stephen King looked to it as a real source of inspiration for when he was writing The Shining.
And what about this director, John Howe? I looked him up. I think I've seen Escape to Witch Mountain on a Disney presentation on ABC once in a while, and I've seen Howling 4, and yeah, I guess it brought back bad memories. Someday, maybe we have to review it just so I can see it again. American Gothic in 88?
Oh, that's horrible. Rod Steiger, terrible. Yvonne De Carlo, terrible. Yeah, love the painting. Terrible movie adaptation of the Grant Wood painting of American Gothic. Terrible, terrible, terrible. But yeah, this director was at an interesting crossroads of horror. This movie came out in 1973, and a lot was going on in the genre. Up to this point, England kind of ruled the roost with Hammer Studios. They had produced a whole lot of mummy and vampire movies with Christopher Lee, Peter Cushing, and they were just old-fashioned. I love them. I personally think they're a lot of fun to enjoy, but they had become passé. By 1973, we had had Rosemary's Baby. This was the year of The Exorcist. There would be British filmmakers that put out The Wicker Man and Don't Look Now. Horror was changing, and this really was clinging to the old way. Legend of Hell House was using James Howe, a Hammer horror director, to try and assert that their style was still relevant. It's not a Hammer film proper, but it does have the influence. It was from a Hammer director, and it was trying to compete with these more realistic horror visions that were going on. But Howe would give up. Yeah, he would end up coming to America and making Disney movies. And personally, I love those Escape from Witch Mountain movies. There were two of them. It's what made me want to be telekinetic. He also made a really weird Bette Davis alien horror movie called Watcher in the Woods. It's got an ending I'll never forget. The point is, his style of horror eventually was deemed Disney, and so he would do genre movies, but at Disney Studios for the rest of the 70s and early 80s, and then, yeah, video schlock into the late 80s, Howling 4, American Gothic, and this really is his best-known work. It is his most celebrated film.
Over Witch Mountain?
Yeah, he personally says that this is his favorite film. I don't know, if you took a poll of kids, depending what it is. And I want to be clear, this is The Witch Mountain from the 70s. The Rock wasn't even born yet.
Well, Stuart, you can tell us about how the book differs from the movie as we go through. But since you read both and actually know this movie before this review, why don't you give us the plot?
Sure. It's Christmas time in England, so naturally the country's three most gifted paranormal investigators are celebrating by spending a week in the recently reopened Belasco Mansion, better known to those in their business as Hell House.
The most random Christmas time setting since Shane Black's last film.
Back in 1929, the place was owned by a sadistic munition scion named Emmerich Belasco, who sexually and mentally abused 27 guests until they were found dead. Two previous investigations into this crime scene ended with ghosts crippling and murdering all the paranormal researchers except for one, Benjamin Fisher, a physical medium played by Roddy McDowall. 20 years later, Fisher has agreed to return to Hell House, accompanied by Florence Tanner, a mental medium played by Pamela Franklin, and physicist Lionel Barrett, played by Clive Revell, who brings along his bored wife Anne, played by Gail Hunnicutt. Few hours into their stay, Florence's powers tell her that there are multiple spirits at work in Hell House, and she befriends one of them that she calls Daniel, and comes up with all kinds of backstory about how Daniel is Emmerich Belasco's son and operating under his father's oppressive influence, all without any really factual basis whatsoever. And so all the blame is going to Emmerich and not Daniel when a black cat tries to claw her back and breasts and throws dishes across the dining room table at Dr. Barrett. But Dr. Barrett has a more scientific approach for what he's witnessing. He's certain there are no ghosts in Hell House. Instead, he opines that the place is a repository of electromagnetic radiation, EMR, left behind by the kinky owner and all the people he killed in his life. Now, because Florence, Lionel, Anne, and Ben aren't cooperating in this current investigation, they're tapping into that residual psychic energy and turning it against one another. And so what looks like to the medium as ghost activity is really passive-aggressive telekinetic behavior. Fortunately, Dr. Barrett has brought along his giant reverser machine, which he intends to use to wipe the house clean of all bad mojo. And for the record, Roddy McDowall's character thinks these two are unnecessarily riling the evil spirit at root in Hell House. His Fisher just wants to sit back and collect the check that's promised to him at the week's end. And so he's completely turned off his psychic abilities. But there is definitely something vicious and kinky at work here. First, Dr. Barrett's wife, Anne, starts acting like a sex-starved hoe while walking in her sleep, stooping to throw herself at Gay Fisher. And then Florence decides the only way to quell the sexually frustrated male spirit she calls Daniel is to offer him her virginity. And that leads to her possession and eventual murder at the chapel, the source of the house paranormal strength. Lionel turns on his reverser machine, and Fisher agrees after a couple hours that it appears to have cleared the place out of evil vibes. But that was all a trick. Emmerich Belasco was just lying low until Lionel's defenses were down, and then he makes the reverser machine explode, killing the physicist and dragging his corpse into the chapel with Florence. And so that leaves Fisher to team up with Anne, who isn't much help at all. I don't know why she's here. But together, mostly Roddy McDowell, but her too, they're going to solve the mystery of Hell House. And that means that he's going to contact the spirit world and prove that there is no Daniel Belasco, only Emmerich Belasco, and this sadistic spirit has been pitting the psychics against one another, making their theories seem more credible than the others as a way of conflating the size of his power and his stature. You see, Belasco is a shower, but not a grower. He is not the roaring giant that legend foretells. In truth, he's a little person who cut off his own legs to walk around on taller prosthetics to give himself a more threatening visage in life. And this is confirmed when Anne and Fisher find Belasco's tiny body preserved in a secret compartment of the chapel. And this is a place, apparently, that Lionel's reverser machine could not reach because the walls were lined with lead. So Fisher just kind of yells at the short sadist, turns the machine on again, and leaves with Anne, perhaps wiping away the legend of Hell House, but at least causing credits to roll.
Couple things in there that you brought up, I wonder if you got from the book. I didn't get from the movie. First of all, I didn't get Roddy McDowell's character to be gay.
Oh, well, I think Roddy kind of brings that charisma here, but it's definitely clear in the book. And here, I think in those scenes, you know, he acts like it's about propriety, but honestly, you can tell there's no heat there. He does not want to get with this beautiful woman.
And like you say, I think that's something Roddy McDowell brings to roles. And the other thing that I didn't get is that Florence Tanner was a virgin.
I didn't get that either, but I just assumed she was like a weird kind of person on the fringe of society based on what she did. So she just dressed very strange and she had the crosses all the time.
Yeah, well, again, you're right. I probably took that from the novel. I'll just go ahead and say it. Richard Matheson adapted his own book. And even though he's very talented in writing teleplays and has written things for the screen that are good, I think it's a bad idea when an author is too close to their source novel, and it works as a source novel. I do like Hell House as a book, but I don't feel like he knew how to change things to make them cinematic. And there was a whole lot to the setup that isn't here in the beginning of this movie that I think will be really confusing for people that don't read the book or don't try to read between the lines here. I don't even know if you'd know why they're being asked to go to this house.
There's the scene with this guy in a wheelchair, Deutsch, and he's yelling at Barrett that you're going to go, and it really feels like I'm thinking of almost Mr. Potter from It's a Wonderful Life, right? The rich guy in the wheelchair who's yelling and throwing his authority around. And he bought the house because the family needed money now. It's really kind of vague how he came into ownership of the Belasco house. But he's going to send this physicist in there. And I thought for sure the way it was being introduced that this Lionel Barrett was going to be the hero and main character of the entire film. I mean, he's here. They're touting his physics background. They're touting how he's the best in his field. So I figured this is going to be a pro-science, anti-psychic film. I was wrong.
Yeah, I was wondering that. Like, if you didn't read the book and didn't know how it was going to end, and I do feel like most of what happens here in the screen, it is what happens on the page, just plays differently because we know more. But I wondered what a viewer would think. When you're seeing this beginning here and this scientist is being asked to come with two psychics that he doesn't appear to think very much about, were you aligned with one over the other?
I guess if I was going with the psychics and I figured that guy would get disproved, which he was.
Yeah.
And I kind of was expecting an all-out Hell House. Like, I was expecting to have the living crap scared out of me by this movie, based on this.
Well, are you telling me you didn't?
Not really. No.
Oh, well, you know, again, keep in mind, 1973, one of the things the director has cited, and I think he's absolutely right, is that if he had been given a year, if this movie had been made in 1974, after The Exorcist had made its imprint and really pushed the boundaries of R-rated entertainment, the things that Linda Blair says and does in that movie totally shattered the rating system, they would be able to do a lot more of the stuff that is in this book. This book is filled with debaucherous things, but this movie is not. And that is because it's a British film and there hadn't been a film on the marketplace to prove that you could be as scandalous as it needed to be.
Was it scandalous in the book, like a lot of sex going on?
Yeah. One thing I would definitely say that if Richard Matheson wasn't adapting this, let's say they gave me the assignment, the thing that I would have inserted in this movie are flashbacks. We needed to know who Emmerich Belasco was. It all comes down to one monologue that Roddy McDowall gives, and that just isn't enough. He says something about cannibalism and bestiality, but it rolls right over you, and you never really have any evidence of any really improper doing in this house. And that is a mistake. We need to presume things about this house in order to be tricked by this house.
And I did pay attention to what McDowell was saying. I mean, he was a drug addict, an alcoholic, sadist, bestiality, mutilation, necrophilia, cannibalism, sadism. And I couldn't even write as fast as he was talking. But to me, this is an extreme version of a setup I've seen so many times before, but in films made later.
Yeah. And it's all the same setup from The Haunting. The Haunting of Hill House, the book, and the movie The Haunting. It had four people going into a haunted house to prove that there is ghosts, that there is an afterlife. That what is not clear here in the setup, but should be, is this man that's hiring them is a newspaper guy who is dying. And he only has a few weeks to live. And he's someone that is trafficked in facts because, of course, newspapers only print facts. And so he wants these people, because of their reputation, to prove that there's an afterlife. The best way to do it is to get access to this house that everyone understands is haunted because so many people have died to investigate.
I got his urgency. I didn't know he was dying, but I think you could just tell me people are obsessed with knowing if there's life after death. Entire worldwide religions throughout the history of humanity have been based on that concept. So I go with anybody's obsession to know about life after death. I wish I knew more about his motivation sending in these people. I don't know why they couldn't get Christmas off and do it in January.
Or maybe in a warmer time of the year, maybe they could wait till spring when it wasn't so cold and dreary.
Yeah, exactly. He sets the ticking clock, but we don't understand why there is a ticking clock because he doesn't look like he's on death's door. Yeah, he's infirmed, but we don't get the sense that he has hours to live. And that's what the book conveys, is that this man has just recently acquired the Belasco house and needs these people to prove it to him quickly. Of course, there's nothing to stop them from making up facts and coming back and saying, oh yeah, there's an afterlife, don't worry. But they take this job seriously. These three people all have a real ethic when it comes to doing their work. They just come from different approaches.
I suppose if they prove there's an afterlife, it could comfort him, but it's not going to change his course. I think he'd be better off spending his money in scientists who might research a cure to whatever's killing him versus looking at ghosts, because one way or another, they'll be like, yes, there's an afterlife. No, there's not. Either way, he's going to find out firsthand real soon.
The consumer in me kind of wondered if he was desperate to find this out to see if he got screwed somehow in a real estate deal.
And here's the thing. It actually was a plot point in the book. At a certain point, they find out that he did die during their week and they're not going to get paid because his son thought this was a stupid idea to begin with and is withholding payment. So it helped create friction in the interpersonal relationships of the house. If you're going to have this as the setup, you needed to do that to increase. I think one of the problems I have with this movie is the sense of tension rarely increases. It's got a whole lot of mood. I really do love this house. When we get there, there's nothing creepier than a fog-laden British mansion, But that's basically what they got here. A really good looking creepy house.
Yeah, it is very good. Really creepy. I couldn't understand the film's obsession with letting me know what time it is every day, virtually every scene.
That killed me. And I kept thinking that was going to pay off somewhere in the movie, and it was going to like either ratchet up the action and show what's happening all the time. Nope, just somebody's boring date and time that meant nothing.
Yeah, the director said it was a new device, that films hadn't been using it yet, and that it did create suspense. Maybe that's true, maybe it's not. I think it had been used before. I didn't care enough to go investigate to see who was the first person that broke down scenes into their hour and date of occurrence. But it seemed to me like the kind of thing you would do in a heist movie, where every second is accounted for. Here, whole days pass, and it's like, what did you guys do? What are you guys doing now that you're moving into Hell House here? The only person that seems to have a real agenda to her day is Florence. She is the mental medium, and that means that she can contact spirits with her mind and converse with them, and so she's going to have sittings, and she's going to talk to whatever she feels is in this house.
Who's making the food and like setting out these elaborate spreads for every meal they're having?
Servants that we never see, at least according to the book.
Okay, I was wondering because I'm like, well, okay, they didn't show up with an army of staff, so someone must be like making these very fanciful dinners where they had to change outfits and come down for dinner wearing something super not cash.
I thought for sure it was Gail Honeycutt's Mrs. Ann Barrett, because why else would she come? I mean, seriously, Marjorie, I love you dearly, but if I got a business trip, you're staying home.
It depends. Are you going to a creepy English castle?
About Anne, just another note on this. She's called Edith in the book, and they had her as an entirely different character. I'm not sure where the choice was made to play her differently, but she was really neurotic. She couldn't leave her husband. She had a phobia about leaving. Maybe it was the line of work. It wasn't really clear why. Or maybe it was just that she had so much anxiety in her own life, she would rather go to a hell house than to spend time alone in a nice hotel.
It depends on the legend. I mean,
the legend is hell house, Marjorie. It's bad.
What? That wasn't very hell housey. I mean,
don't forget this. It's called hell house, and 27 people had sex with each other and died there.
Well, except for the dying part, I mean.
I'll go there tomorrow.
It was like a big orgy, I mean.
Could have been fun. I mean, who's to say?
I think there's a club in Jamaica that's like that sans death.
Yeah.
You're right. It's totally blown out. I mean, this movie will challenge its legend, too. What we know about this house and what happened here is challenged by the end. It's not exactly as its legend purports. But yeah, again, one thing that is sorely missed are just moments where maybe it's the psychics do it. They hold up their hand. The physical medium, that's Roddy McDowell. If he touches things, he can sense what happened there. If he touched the table and we saw a dinner scene with the old guests, I think that would be really powerful. But I don't think they had the money on this production for large casts, for big setups, for doing that kind of thing. And I don't think Richard Matheson wanted to change that much about his novel.
And the fact that Roddy McDowell's character, Franklin Fisher, is closed off. He was, as you mentioned in your plot summary, but to drive it home, the only, well, they say he's the only survivor. He's the only one to get out without broken legs and things. Because in the end, we're going to find out, oh, this guy did survive, but he's insane. And this person survived, but they jumped out the window and broke both their legs. A lot of survivors, they were just casualties.
I agree.
I hope I don't break my leg. And he's like, oh, you're dead. I'm going to leave now.
And they should have consolidated. I mean, there's a lot of lip service to saying there was two investigations. Roddy McDowell's character was only involved in one. Four of them died, apparently, in the first one that we never hear anything about.
Which means they stubbed a toe and a hangnail.
But again, I think there should have just been one investigation, and that Roddy is the sole survivor. And the idea that other people, yeah, paralyzed or gone insane, no, they're dead. Dead means dead. A sole survivor means there's nobody else they can go to. I mean, they could wheel somebody in, and I think this dying man would if he believed that bringing a survivor to him would get him closer to the answer.
But because he was the one who came out unscathed, is how I'll put it, Fisher is completely closing himself off. He could be like Johnny Smith in the Dead Zone, touch the table and see that they had bad clams. But he's not going to do that. His goal is to get in, get out, and get his third of the money. Does it say how much they're getting?
Well, we know that Lionel Barrett is getting 100,000 pounds. It's England.
So assuming it's 100,000 pounds per person, and that's back when that was a lot of money, he's there just to basically do a fear factor type thing. If you could stay in this house for 5 days, you get the $100,000, whether or not you engage your psychic powers. The other two, though, are there to research, and we've got Lionel Barrett, Dr. Barrett, Clive Revel. I've met this man. I looked him up because I thought he was a British actor of great note. He has done quite a bit of television. This, from what I can tell, was his first film. His second, the one I got his autograph for, was The Empire Strikes Back.
Voice actor. He was the voice of the Emperor, apparently.
Yes, in the unadulterated editions, where it was a woman's face with baboon eyes, he was the voice of the Emperor's hologram that was replaced by Ian McDiarmid in the fourth or fifth special edition. He's also getting golden headphones from us. We reviewed him at the Transformers retrospective.
Yeah, he's the voice of some Autobot.
Yes, in the animated film, he is Kickback.
I hope it's a big one.
And in the video game for Revenge of the Fallen, he was Jetfire, if you remember the old airplane.
Who could forget? Who could name any of those? I still can't tell one Transformer from the other.
Don't be a Transformerist, Stuart.
So, golden headphones for a man who hasn't done much. It is saying something if we're giving golden headphones for three series to a man who only did five films.
I think this actor has presence, and this cast is hard to get behind. It's hard for me to root for one theory over another, because no one's really convincing me that they know what they're talking about. Florence seems like she's a real hippy-dippy fool, and Roddy McDowall is so shut down he's not doing anything, and I don't know what she wants to do, but Lionel is the one that just has credibility with me. I mean, this movie started with a quote from a psychic, you know, and I think that the whole tack of this movie is what I believed was that it was going to have science validate the paranormal. And Lionel just, yeah, I'm with this character throughout this movie. It would have been a surprise to me had I not read the book that his theories are leading him to his death. I would think that the dead character would be his wife, because that's kind of how it played in the original Haunting, was that during the investigation, the wife and the innocent character who wasn't psychic, but came in here just sort of as a control lab test. Sorry, spoiler alert. She ended up getting sucked into the house.
See, I really thought that his science was going to uncover new things. 1973, when this came out, I look at science as really coming to the forefront, computers and all that, and the growth. I thought for sure he was going to find a way to psychically explain the terror, and that, like in Poltergeist, well, I guess they needed Tangina in Poltergeist, but I was thinking about the scientists in Poltergeist being able to deconstruct the house. I thought that's what he was doing. And when, yeah, you get Florence Tanner coming in her long flowing gowns, I'm going to have a seance. I'm looking at her like she's the crazy one. With all the jewelry, she's basically a 70s gypsy coming into this house. I don't believe her. And I expect something that doesn't happen. I expect somebody is going to lie. I expect somebody's going to make some crap up. And they accuse each other of it in this film. But really, everybody here, they are the best in their field. The rich guy picked well. And they're all going to have their own experiences and put forward what they think is the truth.
Yeah, they're actually all going to solve it together. Roddy McDowall is going to be able to take the pieces left behind by the others and solve it, and Anne's going to stand there and watch him do it.
I really thought she was going to be one of the first to die. I expected a hell of a lot more deaths for a place called Hell House.
Sure, but I mean, again, you would expect that from a movie called Hell House today. If they remade this, you would expect gore. But 1973 British to me, it should be said, this didn't necessarily have to be a British production. The book is set in America. Richard Matheson is an American. And all of this was adapted because the producer had more connections to Hammer Studios and English location shooting. But I think it works. I mean, I really do think that instantly, yeah, just being in a creepy mansion full of cobwebs, it creates a vibe. It, you know, they're able to build on the back of that old-fashioned scare factory. And so that's the kind of horror I'm looking for. You have to kind of like those creaky old house kind of movies where it's not about blood and guts.
But yet, by having her here, I agree. I thought they were trying to up the body count. I mean, I think about Psycho and The Omen around this time, there were deaths along the way. I did think that she was going to die. She seemed useless. She really did. She has an arc. Was she more useful in the book? I mean, she's here to rip her clothes off a couple of times. She's going to be impacted by it. But other than her neuroses, was she helpful in the house? I think it would have been more useful if she truly was the one making the food instead of these unseen servants.
Yeah, she did nothing except show off her boobs, I think.
Yeah, and we didn't even see those.
No, at key times, I think you got a hint of it, but
no, that wasn't her. That wasn't her that did the nude shot.
Okay, so did she do anything?
She did do one thing. She slept with David Hemmings, a very successful British actor that I think the producers wanted to work with, and thus they cast her in this role. But what she didn't want to do, I presume, is what her character does in the book, which is a whole lot of sexual deviance. And some of that is the restrictions of the time frame. After Exorcist, maybe your mama can suck cocks in hell, but before Exorcist, she fills up a bust, literally a statue of a woman. That's as kinky as it gets. She talks about having a three-way with the others, but that's about it. Yeah, she gets possessed, and her character, if they were to follow the book, and I'm not sure why they didn't, she's much younger than Lionel, and he is not able to sexually perform. He actually walks with a cane and I think has some problems downstairs, and so she's sexually frustrated. Coming into this house where all this kinky behavior happens, it really opens her up and she starts performing and doing things that are unseemly.
When you discuss that, it makes me think of a movie we reviewed late last year, From Beyond. If you remember that film, that also had the haunted house where the deviant lived, and when they get exposed to his machine, they start wearing S&M gear and acting out various demented things. I would like to see, perhaps, an update of this story in modern times where you actually could explore the psychosexual supernatural subtext.
It's crying for it in this movie, but I want to throw some compliments in here as well. Yes, this movie is dry and British and very much of its time. Not even of its time, because in 1973 we had Rosemary's Baby, where we watched a woman be raped by Satan. You could go further than they were willing to go to. The director's previous movie was apparently the first Hammer movie about lesbian witches or vampires or vampire witches. I didn't see it yet, but I'm going to. But again, I feel like they could have took chances. Maybe some of this is this actress feeling like she didn't want to present herself in that way. But what is, I think, the substitute for that is the mood, the lighting, the sound effects, the cinematography particularly. I really like all the lighting setups here. Like when we have the sitting with the red light and the way that it frames the crucifix, all of the close-ups. I do think you're getting something out of that.
I'll agree that this is a really good-looking film. When it's lit by firelight, the reds, the set design. I read this was filmed in Elstree, so I'm guessing these are all sets?
Yeah, the exterior was a real house, but everything was shot on a soundstage. That was interior.
I will be honest, at the very beginning, it had a little jaunty music, and I noticed that people were very fashionable. I mean, they seemed to be wearing what was in fashion for the times, and it looked runway ready, and I kind of got an Argento vibe off of it, and then it just like blew that all to hell. So I was kind of hoping for that, but it's still very pretty. It's not as pretty as his with the style and everything, but I kind of got that feel at the beginning, and then there wasn't much to follow up on there.
No eye gouging. Yes, if Argento had made this, we know there would have been blood. But
yes.
Instead, you're right, it's very mod. It's got that 60s mod feeling. This director had also made episodes of The Avengers. That's nothing to do with Marvel. Look it up. BBC show.
Emma Peel.
But to me, there's a lot of that just to groove on. It's a personal taste thing. If you're not into that, well, I don't know what this movie has for you. But for me, in the scene where, yeah, they sit down the second time and she's going to produce ectoplasm from her fingers, it may not be photorealistic, it's certainly not gory, but I think it's cool.
I did like the "put the sample in the jar, please."
Yeah.
I thought that was very British of him to ask the ghost to please put the sample in the jar.
Doesn't he get a magazine or something? I mean, that's hard to produce, right? Just on the spot. You can tell this guy is a cold scientist. He's got no feeling for mood. But funny thing, this director actually had mediums and spiritualists on the set. He really thought that they could do this for them. They didn't know how they were going to do this effect. He's like, why don't you just sit there and produce this ectoplasm? And funny enough, they couldn't.
Oh, because they might be frauds.
I mean, I wouldn't go that far, but it certainly gave the animators something to do here.
Yeah, it was interesting effect. I actually had no problem with the effects for the time. Again, with my comparatives being Poltergeist and Ghostbusters, not every animation in those was photorealistic either. I wasn't quite sure what I was seeing. I mean, at first, because I've got the Emperor here, I thought there was electricity coming out of her fingertips, and it kept going. Finally, he said ectoplasm. I'm like, okay. And I am seeing, again, some origination here for concepts that we would see in Poltergeist and Ghostbusters in another decade.
Yeah, and again, I really like this notion. You mentioned From Beyond, and I think it's kind of got a similar idea. There's a whole world that we can't see with our eyes, but that we produce, that responds to us, that we let off this EMR. The idea that ghosts could be nothing more than our passive-aggressive feelings manifesting with however much EMR is in a particular space. That's a cool idea.
And it's one that I've seen in so many movies, that strong emotions lead to hauntings. You know, it's not necessarily your entire intelligence sitting there like Beetlejuice, you know, with Gina Davis and Alec Baldwin having conversations while Winona Ryder moves in, but more when you have extreme feelings, it can leave resonances in the house and lead to evil spirits. So none of this was new to me, but I imagine it all would have been in 73.
Yeah, that's the important thing you have to keep in mind, is that maybe this movie doesn't stay relevant, but at the time it would have felt relevant, and it would have very much felt like a response, not quite a diss, but a challenge to Shirley Jackson and The Haunting to say, oh, you always want to make it that these people and their inner turmoil is the reason for the hauntings. Nope, I'm going to play with that. We're going to make you think that that's the case here. And at the end of the day, these people aren't producing what's attacking them. There is a real ghost. He really is evil. And yeah, he wants to hurt them any way he can, including through killer cats.
That cat was something.
I love when it's like, when they close the door on it and its paw is trying to come underneath the door jam.
Well, you know, that's where it looks fake, but sometimes it did look real. Like, they say they didn't throw a cat, but there were a couple shots where I'm like, they threw that cat. They hurt that cat. I mean, they land on their feet, and if you had read the book, there was a whole lot about the backstory of Emmerich having killed cats to see if they had nine lives as a kid. It was where he started his sadism, and there was just a relationship there. But, you know, it's a horror movie, a black cat. You can just always throw him in. They always go with everything.
And everything is getting thrown around here. They also have a dinner where the arguing starts. I mean, this is almost like the real world. Hell House edition. What happens when four scientists stop being polite and start getting real? They argue over dinner. And then things start happening. The chandelier smashes.
I honestly thought that they were going to find that it was feeding off everyone's anger. I mean, they were accusing Florence of doing this, that they were going to eventually discover that whatever entity there was feeding off their anger and distrust of each other. And it was going to somehow parlay into that, or parlay into some great teamwork that was going to happen. No, they just all hated each other and died hating each other.
It's the ghost toaster from Ghostbusters 2.
Yeah, I do feel there should have been more camaraderie here. In order for Emmerich to pit them against one another, there needed to be some kind of alliance to break between them. Like, we just needed more in the get-go. I mean, there are literally only a few seconds of shots in the beginning of Roddy McDowall getting off a train, her walking out of a church. We didn't know them as people, and we didn't know why they came here other than presumably the money. And that's a mistake. There needed to be more humor. There needed to be more interpersonal connections. And then you could break them down. Then you have somewhere to go in the middle of this movie where it does just become a series of jump scares and haunted house cliches. What also would have been helpful is they take a long time to explain the reverser machine. That should have been like day one. Here's what I believe. We can wipe it out when my machine gets delivered. And the psychic needs to say, absolutely not. You're going to put all these spirits that I know are here into an unfair actual hell. And we needed to see that concept earlier. That comes at the climax of this film.
And what exactly is the problem with putting Belasco into an actual hell when he was a cannibal, necrophiliac, bestiality? Isn't that kind of what hell was invented to be?
Well, keep in mind, she believes, and again, this is all things she's saying. You just have to take it on her word that she's picking it up from voices. There's all this whispering and thumping going on in the sound mix. And to her, that means there are multiple spirits here. This is a controlled multiple haunting, several ghosts doing the will of one evil force, which is Emmerich Belasco. It's hard to understand why she sold on Daniel and why she would love him so much that she would literally offer herself sexually to him. Again, if you read the book, she's never had sex before. She's so religious. The only thing they got is at some point she goes to a wine cellar and finds a secret compartment where there's a skeleton. And she says, that's Daniel. Well, they don't even show you that he's wearing like Daniel's shirt or ring or anything like that. There's no reason to believe that's Daniel as opposed to any of the other 27 victims.
I kind of figured this is where she was becoming unhinged because they had already undermined her and put in my head that she was causing all this. And I thought maybe she was somehow behind some of this and maybe she was a long lost daughter of Belasco when she's trying to keep the scare going. And you're right. And the reason I thought this was because you just showed me a dead body in shackles. How the hell am I supposed to know who it is?
I also went with her. If she's the psychic, well, then she would be the one to tell me that's Daniel. But when the movie's over, we find out there never was a Daniel, so who was this body?
Agreed. I think there needed to be a Daniel. Again, if we had had flashbacks or even just more clear dialogue, why not say that Emmerich had children? One of the things that got excised from the book, and I know why they did it, but there was a swamp, a bog outside called Bastard's Bog, and it was because everyone was aborting their children and throwing them into the swamp. And so there would have been reason to believe that Emmerich, having impregnated so many women, would have a child that survived, or maybe a mother hid it from him. All of this stuff would be interesting things to tease. Again, it's a case that could unfold through the middle of this movie where I feel like nothing really new is being learned.
I'll agree. I'm intrigued because there is this escalation constantly. They're getting more and more attacks. They're getting more and more wounded. Things are getting a little crazier, but it is taking a while to get there. And to look at the arc that you asked about with Florence, though, again, because I saw her kind of as a hippie, and this was during the free love movement. I mean, I really think of it in the late 60s, but because of that, I never took her as a virgin, and if she felt so bad for this lost spirit that had had such a horrible life and she did think this would help him to move on, there was nothing out of character for that for me, but I didn't take her to be super religious, and I didn't take her to be a virgin, all of which would have added more questions to that act. But that's a very interesting scene where she's like, with love, and then you see her and she's clawed, bruised. There was no love.
Yeah, I thought that was actually one of the more effective moments. It's played just right. We don't need it to be graphic. We don't need to see an assault. It's basically a close-up on her face where she's trying to be okay with this. And then she opens her eyes and presumably sees, or at least, you know, with her third eye, sees more of the character of the person that's been insulting her. And it's not Daniel, the sweet ghost that she thought. It feels a lot like the rape in Rosemary's Baby. If you know that movie, there's a really disquieting scene that Mia Farrow has, where she's drugged and strapped down by the other guests in the apartment. And it does feel like they're playing off of that and getting pretty close to that ickiness.
Yeah, I had definitely a Rosemary's Baby thought many times during this movie. You know, all this 70s supernatural demon horror is of a specific flavor, and this is in that same cabinet.
It's very specific of the time period, too, because if you look at the cyclical nature of what scares us, it vacillates between real people and demons. Real people and demons. I mean, if you just wait a couple of years, we get things like The Last House on the Left and things like that, because we start the heyday of slasher films.
Yeah, this is a movie that's going to challenge whether ghosts are even real, and thus, are ghosts scary, or are they doing it to themselves? I just never get on board with that, even though I'm on board with Lionel. That would be quite something if they could pull an ending out here where it's like, I literally can turn on this big machine, and the problem goes away. Poof.
I didn't ever think they were doing it to themselves, as in, God help me, Book of Shadows, Blair Witch 2, where they may just be insane and there is no supernatural explanation, but I did wonder if they were, as Marjorie had said, causing it upon themselves through psychic manifestations. There's all this questioning, because when things are being thrown, Florence is like, well, I'm a mental medium, and Fisher, you're the physical medium, and so they're blaming each other. Who's causing this? Who is the channel? Could one of them be doing it subconsciously? I never questioned whether or not there was something supernatural. I did question if there was a Belasco, though.
Yeah, and that's something that should be pointed out. If there were sin here, just to prove if there's an afterlife, you can go home now. Your job is not to clear this house. It was just to say, hey, there's a supernatural force. And I think they've all agreed on that. There is something ectoplasmic that can be documented by science that will react with the way that people behave in the room. But I guess that's not proof that there's a heaven or hell. And that's probably what they were being tasked to find.
But that's not what I got off the task. You're right. The task was to prove that there was some form of life after death. And you are right that Lionel has gotten all of that with his readings. And then the other two, certainly Fisher isn't going to deny it. He won't even open himself up. He's so certain of it. And Florence is certainly believing it. Again, I kind of took this as like a Fear Factor thing. I didn't think they would be allowed to leave in less than 5 days. Like, you must stay there for 5 days. And now that Marjorie mentioned a real estate deal, yeah, I'm wondering, did they need to clear the house for this guy? Because this guy was so nebulous to me, I never took it that he wouldn't want the house cleaned for, I don't know, a nice summer home?
Yeah, it all worked better in The Haunting, where it was about a guy that wanted the proof. He rented this house from the owner. He brought these people. There was discussion about leaving, but the innocent woman felt like she didn't have a home to go back to, and that there was something about her past that this house seemed to be fixing. And again, is it all in her mind, or is there, you know, a gateway being opened here? It just played a whole lot better in The Haunting. Here it's clumsy, and I can't even say that it's perfectly succinct in the book, but it does play better in the book, and it certainly is more lurid and creepy. And by this point, when he's turning on the machine, we're near the end. It's some of the last pages. We're hoping that that does the trick.
Yeah, and we do get to that point. I gotta say, he's pretty okay with his wife's complete hoishness. I mean, not once, but twice. And he confronts Fisher and is like, why didn't you tell me? And he's like, well, it's kind of your wife's job to tell you, not mine.
Yeah. Again, where is she going with that? I mean, I don't think that that's going to the bedroom at any time. She'd have more luck with the cat than she would with Fisher.
The pussy gets pussy.
Oh.
Or, yeah, go that way. I mean, that was a thing in The Haunting, was that there was a lesbian. That was actually, her lesbianism is what made her so odd and psychic. And here, I think that is a subtext of Fisher, is that his homosexuality is part of what made him such a great physical psychic. But again, flashbacks would have helped to show that. We're just told that in dialogue.
Yeah, and so when the big piece of Star Trek machinery gets dropped off, I am ready for something to happen. And I'm like, okay, this is here. I didn't expect, though, after being for lack of a better term, raped by a ghost, that still Florence is going to try to defend them and grab a fire poker and try to smash the gauges.
Yeah, it's where is that coming from? Is it because she's possessed, or is it because, like Lionel calls out later, that she had to destroy my beliefs before I destroyed hers?
I kind of felt that she was half obsessed with the thought of Daniel being a tortured soul, and she seemed like she had a lot of empathy and sympathy for him, and she was afraid he would get trapped in between and not be able to get to where he needs to belong. And I also felt that the other half of her motivation was she disdained all this science in favor of her own avenue of how she conducted her psychicness.
Yeah.
Yeah, all of her spouting off about Daniel does lead to that assumption, Marjorie, I agree. But I'm sorry, for all the warm fuzzies you have for Daniel, after he beats the crap out of you during sex, I think you gotta just turn that off.
And they've really changed something here. Again, it's hard to know why or what. If you have the writer of the book writing the screenplay, it had to be a decision that was made by the director, the actors, or the producers. Florence kills herself in the book. That when she goes into the chapel and the crucifix falls on her, she's made to slice her own wrist. I don't think that's clear in this version. I don't think someone watching this movie would see that, right?
No, not at all. I just thought she was killed by being crushed by a big cross. A very creepy cross with, like, the devil on it instead of Jesus.
Yeah, exactly. And again, there were a lot of sacrilegious movies getting in trouble at this time. There was a movie called The Devils by Ken Russell that had come out the previous year and wouldn't receive a theatrical release for about 40 years because it was too hot button, and it's hard to do. I mean, it's hard to make a commercially viable movie that shows eroticism, Satanism, and Christianity. Exorcist did it well. Devils alienated its entire audience, and this movie just doesn't go there except for an art-directed piece here and there.
But she is the first to go. They think that they've knocked her out, and they decide to turn on the machine. They don't notice her going to that chapel, which the chapel seems to be the core of a lot of things. And yet, did they film other scenes there? Because if so, they didn't frame those scenes to really drive home they were in the chapel.
The machine wasn't in the chapel, but the rest of the movie is. They set up the idea that Florence could never go in there. There was just so much bad mojo. The spirits were yelling too loudly for her to stand walking into that room. So if she had been able to do so, she would have guessed the surprise that it's left for Fisher to figure out. When she goes in there, she realizes, and as she's dying, she realizes that only Belasco is in this house, and she feels like the best way to convey that is to write in blood the letter B in a circle. I guess.
I was totally confused by that, because, one, I didn't hear they were saying Belasco at the beginning, and I know somebody named Velasco, so I thought it was that.
Oh, okay. You were seeing V's instead of B's. Yeah, I wouldn't want her as my win, lose, and draw partner.
No.
I mean, no, she sucks. Yeah.
But I was thoroughly mystified with the B, and I couldn't even tell that was a B. I'm like, what the hell is she doing?
I thought it might be an R or some religious symbol. Honestly, it did kind of look like Robin from Batman and Robin, the R with the circle. So I didn't quite know if it was going to be a symbol. Honestly, I trusted the film would tell me, but I didn't get off of it what she was trying to do. They do run the machine, and as far as Fisher can tell, the house is clean. He opens himself up and feels nothing until they find that body.
Right. Well, first it should be said, they find Franklin in the place where he's going to have all his discoveries. Franklin has a moment where we get to see him humiliated for his hubris. He thought that his machine was infallible, and in fact, it did not rid the house of its one and only evil spirit. And I just wanted to, like, hear some Thomas Dolby there, like, da-na-na-na, he blinded me with science.
Science!
Yeah, it just kind of blows. There's like a blood spatter. And I think that killed him. I think he was killed by his own instrument. I think that was the irony they were going for. And then some force drags him into the chapel and sticks candles in him.
Is that what happened? I honestly thought he was killed by the Force. Like, he's like, oh, well, we're all done now. And then, yeah, I saw stuff happen, but I didn't think, like, his machine malfunctioned. I thought Belasco, not dead, decided to kill him, which means Belasco could have killed any of them at any time and decided to wait 4 days first.
Yeah, again, if you understood the nature of Belasco, he was someone, they do kind of establish that in one weak scene in the beginning of the movie. There's a record playing where you think you hear Belasco, but no, it's just his voice on a record. The point was he would play that for party guests, and they were, you know, going to where they thought he was, and he could secretly pull pranks on them. This is a character that is always lurking in the shadows, inviting guests into traps and punking them, essentially. So that's what he does here with Lionel. He punks him with this machine, and then, again, the candles, this is something they added for the movie. I don't get.
The guy's just a jerk is what it boils down to. Belasco is kind of a tool. How he likes to trick his friends and then rape and murder them.
Yeah, he's that kind of friend.
Plus, then, he's going to kill you and stick candles in your eyes.
Yeah.
But it all comes to a head after Lionel is dead. For some reason, Anne's like, well, I'm not going to leave. I'm just going to stand next to you, Fisher, so that you have somebody to tell everything to. So that, you know, it's like why Sherlock needed Holmes. Is so Sir Arthur Conan Doyle could rationally explain why everything was being said out loud.
Not only that, she's like cinema's most rested individual. As her husband dies, she's like, I need a nap. And then like later she finds the body and she sleeps three times and it's not even noon. Like, we know the time on the watch. And like, I don't get it. Do you have narcolepsy? What is going on with Anne? I'm surprised she stayed awake when they're knocking Roddy McDowell around on the wires. You can see the wires too when he's being yanked around, being slapped around, calling out the spirits. Again, it's not satisfying. It's Deus Ex Machina that all of a sudden just he can use his physical powers and know everything that happened. And he doesn't really deduce anything. He just suddenly all of a sudden knows Belasco was short.
Yeah, and he's going to do the most smart thing and just start making fun of Belasco. The only thing that Fisher doesn't know is that behind one of the stained glass windows in the chapel is the lead room with Belasco's body. He doesn't know that, but he knows Belasco was so short that he cut off his legs. I think you described him as a little person, Stuart. I don't know that he was that short because we do see Belasco's body, and it's not like it was a little person with big legs. He had normal length arms and everything. He didn't look like the little man from another place on stilts.
I think that's what we're supposed to go for. What he looks like is Michael Goh, who would go on to play Alfred to Michael Keaton's Batman in the Tim Burton universe.
And Val Kilmer's Batman, and George Clooney's Batman.
Oh, wow. Was he in all four?
Yes, he was the reason I knew those were all the same universe.
Okay, fair enough.
He's Alicia Silverstone's Uncle Alfred.
He also fought Trog with Joan Crawford, a hilarious B-movie from around the same time. But yeah, at this point, yeah, they, again, should have been a character. Just see him here, frozen in waxwork, holding a brandy snifter. It's not even clear. Is he dead? What's going on? Like, it's clearly the actor is breathing, but we're expected to think that this is just his mummified body.
And as far as I can tell, this isn't even Christmas, right? This is Christmas Eve. Why this is set at Christmas is still confounding me. I thought for sure it would all come to a head on Christmas morning.
Well, I mean, because, you know, Christ rose from the dead. Is there an afterlife? The promise of Christianity? I mean,
that's Easter. He was born on Christmas.
I know, but yes. Again, it's colder at Christmas. You can have more cloudy, foggy days, I guess.
But wait, look, let's go back, though. Let's go back to this Belasco and the craziness here. He cut off his own legs so he could get taller ones.
Can I do that?
What?
Soon. I do believe in the future science will... Who needs a reverser? We will be able to be whatever we want to be with a couple injections.
I think that was in Gattaca, right? Didn't they do that in Gattaca?
I'm sure. And here's the thing. It's in the book, but it's really downplayed. They don't make up this whole thing about how every person that came in the house was like beaten on the legs and, you know, had their extremities cut out so that they could be short. It didn't feel like a short man's rage, some Napoleon complex being taken out on the investigators. It was just mentioned in passing in the final page of the book that it was something that this creepy guy who had done a lot of weird things had done to be creepy. So I didn't take it to be this big aha moment of course, never trust the short guy because he'll come back as a ghost to, you know, hobble your knees.
Don't want no short people now. But
yeah, this was badly played. I don't think you should have played that aspect up. It doesn't have the aha moment of solving a mystery you want to lead the audience with.
Yeah, if he had his own legs cut off because he didn't like being short, why was he crushing everybody else's legs? This seems like something a polio victim would do. Like, if I have no legs, no one will have legs.
Yeah, they go with a biblical quotation that Florence had picked up on early upon arrival. If thine eye offend thee, pluck it out. And I guess if thy legs are taller, well, yeah, I'm going to whack you down to size.
I also had one other thought going into this. And this is crazy. But I kind of thought, like, in the first 30 minutes that Roddy McDowall was going to be, like, the Scooby-Doo old man part. And he was in on it since he seemed kind of shifty and quiet. Like, they were going to finally get down to, like, the last few minutes and it's going to come out that he was causing this because, like, he had a neighbor property and he wanted to tear it down or something.
Yeah, you definitely were creating a Scooby-Doo episode in your head. And for all I know, it probably was one. Again, this is a story. Hell House is something that many writers of sitcoms and future horror movies have read and repurposed. So, yeah, I think that we have all seen the ripoffs of this. And so we've seen the variations on Hell House.
But Roddy McDowall comes around. Science will win the day as he's like, all right, well, I found your body. I've opened the door to your lead room. Superman's X-ray vision can get in here now. So let me turn on the machine and walk out the door.
If you open the door to the lead room, does that mean that the EMR is going to get in there and wipe him out? I don't feel like it's conclusive. I'd rather have, like, hauled the body out just to make sure and, like, stuck it in front of the machine. Hell, it exploded. Are we sure this machine is going to work?
It was the worst, like, throwing a lit match in a gasoline house, like, ever. You know, that's kind of, like, how I felt they're leaving it. But on the other end, when they're walking away, it just was so anticlimactic with that.
The director has promised he wants to make a sequel. I think he's dead now, but who knows?
44 years ago when they're going to make a sequel?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's weirder things have happened.
Well, I don't know how John will do it as... he is still alive. I mean, John Howe is 75 years old. He could totally pull a George Miller and do a Mad Max Fury Road version of Hell House 2.
Yeah, and they left the cat. I mean, that's one of the things when they're leaving. They know there's something supernatural there because that cat was dead, bloody in a shower. And then upon leaving the house, it's there to give them the eye. So I guess it's going to be about the cat. Who's the only actor that they can use at this point?
I'd say do a remake that's more close to the book and then do the sequel to it. But let's see how you guys feel about this. Marjorie Stewart, do you recommend The Legend of Hell House? Marjorie.
Oh man, I am so on the fence with this one. On one hand, I really love a good ghost story that will scare the heck out of me, and this one didn't scare me. It was pretty to look at, and that's kind of got what it's going for it, but I guess this is kind of a, you need to see it for the history of horror, but I don't think you need to see it for the scare or shock value because there isn't any. And there's a lot wrong with the film story-wise, and it sounds like the book covered a lot of it, so maybe just read the book instead. And do this as a compendium after you read the book.
So, not recommend.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't hear anything that you're strongly endorsing in this movie.
I had a good time while I watched it, but I don't know it's a must-see. So, I guess I'd recommend it in the annals of horror history, but not as any other reason to see the film. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I've used that same horror homework kind of analogy for movies like The First Exorcist, First Texas Chainsaw Massacre, Stuart.
Yeah, it didn't hold up. I admit that what I enjoyed about this in childhood, in the light of adulthood, does not have the same power. What I responded to then and now is the mood. I think that has been well preserved. I really like the camera work. I really like the setting. I think this movie is influential. I think The Shining, I think Poltergeist took ideas from this. But I also think this took most of its ideas from 1963's Robert Wise's The Haunting. That is the genuine classic. This is no horror classic. This is an inferior response to a classic work. But if you're a fan of The Haunting, and I'm a big fan of it, a definite strong endorsement for the 1963 movie, I think that I'm going to give this one a weak recommendation as counterpoint. It's kind of the same recommendation I gave Rob Zombie's Halloween, a movie that I thought also had story problems, did not perfect a horror classic, but had enough about its mood that was different that made me appreciate the way that you could reconstrue familiar beats. And so that's what I would say. If you love The Haunting, here's an interesting take on it that doesn't totally work as a story. But for a fun Sunday afternoon, when the lights are still on, I think it can be fun to watch. It's not one to scare you, but it is one to impress you.
And I'm also right there on that fence. I mean, on the one hand, it did have really good set design. I liked seeing Roddy McDowall in an early performance other than when he's in an ape suit. I haven't seen that much of his 70s stuff and before. And I liked some of the concepts here that were teased. I liked the fact that it did introduce a sexual concept to ghosts that a lot of these movies do avoid. By the same token, nothing was really well defined. The movie dragged for quite a bit. It's not a long movie, but it certainly takes its time getting there. It's 90 minutes. And I thought the ending ended up being a little bit ridiculous with Roddy McDowall standing there just screaming about short people.
They got no reason to live. Randy Newman was right.
But in the end, I think I'm going to come down on a really weak recommend. I mean, it's right there on the line, but the movie intrigued me. Here's the irony. If you're listening to this podcast and haven't seen the movie, don't bother seeing it. Not recommend. Because what I found fun was the exploration of the mystery of Belasco and Daniel and all of that. What was real, what wasn't, is what kept me interested. If you know the answers to that, there's nothing here. I won't return to it. It is certainly not a favorite, but I did have enough fun watching it, and the suspense was there and the intrigue was there enough that I think even though I've seen so many derivatives and improvements on this story in the 44 years since, I think this one still has some enjoyment to be had discovering what's in Hell House.
Yeah, you gotta like old-fashioned movies. I mean, I would say this. If you saw Grindhouse and you wanted to know what the hell that Edgar Wright trailer for Don't was, it's this movie, right?
Yeah, that's exactly it. Yeah. Like Wright has said, he was thinking about this with Don't. Of course, Don't was far more entertaining than any of this.
Well, yeah, you get what this movie does in 90 minutes in about a minute. So, again, it's all about how you want to spend your time. To me, I call this a Sunday afternoon horror movie. It's not going to scare you. You don't have to turn off the lights. But there is just something comforting. It's just comfort food. If you like creepy old houses where, yeah, cobwebs and spirits knock over things, I like the accoutrements of Hammer horror. So it was fun to see them well done and well shot.
Yeah, I didn't feel like I'd wasted. I literally watched this on a Sunday afternoon, and I didn't feel like I wasted my time. So Jason, thank you so much for picking it and exposing me to this. I did feel it does have the homework aspect Marjorie mentioned. I feel like, oh, so that's where this came from in later movies. But it also did pass the time enjoyably. So thank you so much for your support of our show, Jason. We greatly, greatly appreciate it.
And if you want some more homework, guys, promise me sometime you're going to get back to that 1963 horror movie, the real classic, the one where they all come from, The Haunting. It still holds up. It's still good. I know it's black and white. I know it's PG, but it's still scary.
Maybe someday we'll get to that retrospective. Maybe sometime with the next Amityville or whatever.
And patrons, stay tuned. If you like horror, that's what we're going to do next. As we get closer to Halloween, we're going to do a one-off that was very popular this year. It remains one of my favorite films of 2017. Get Out!
Yeah, you know, I'd like to actually make this a now-playing tradition now that we have this patron outlet to do one-offs. I think every Halloween, we should do, like, the most acclaimed small horror film of that year. We did it with It Follows, and it introduced me to a great horror film. I've not seen Get Out. I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, it's not quite like It Follows, but I definitely think there's a lot to talk about, and you, I, and Jacob will be talking about it soon.
And I do also want to remind everyone, in just a few weeks, we're doing our second live podcast review on Saturday, September 24th, 8 p.m. Eastern. We're going to be reviewing Kingsman: The Golden Circle live at nowplayingpodcast.com with a Q&A with us hosts after. So we hope you can join us Sunday, September 24th at 8 p.m. Eastern. That's 0000 GMT for that live podcast review. It should be a lot of fun. So patrons, thank you for listening. And now, get out of this house before I kill you all!
Your husband at Florence helped us to rid this house of Belasco. Let us hope that their spirits guide him to everlasting peace.
Thank you to all the listeners who have backed us through our Podbean crowdfunding campaign, and we hope you've enjoyed this special bonus movie review podcast.
Get out or I'll hurt you. I can't help myself. I don't want to hurt you. I must.
Now Playing relies on support from listeners like you to keep going. So thanks to you all.
How did it end?
If it had ended, we would not be here.
And a special thank you to Jason Fisher for his support of the show and choosing this movie for our review.
The house tried to kill me. It almost succeeded.
Now that you've heard this review, head to the Now Playing Podcast forums and share your thoughts on this movie. The link to our forums is at nowplayingpodcast.com.
Drug addiction, alcoholism, sadism, bestiality, mutilation, murder, vampirism, necrophilia, cannibalism, not to mention a gamut of sexual goodies. Shall I go on?
The Legend of Hell House film, all audio clips and music used are the property of the respective copyright holders, and no infringement is intended. This podcast has not been prepared, approved, or licensed by any entity that created or produced that film or novel. Now Playing is an independent movie review podcast with no affiliation with any company involved in the publishing, creating, or distribution of that film or book.
The Lord certainly does move in mysterious ways.
So does this house.
Now Playing is a Venganza Media production, copyright 2017, all rights reserved. And no part of this show may be reproduced, repurposed, or redistributed without the written permission of Venganza Media Incorporated.
Directed by John Ho. Who? How? How?
Yeah, I would go with how. The Ho is the wife.
I've never seen any of the Amityville.
Not only have you not seen them, you can't even say them.
Now, what about this director, John Ho? Ho? Ho?
I'm going with Ho.
How?
Yeah, How, yeah. I'm going with Ho. I want to say Ho. That's basically all it is.
Maybe someday we'll get to that retrospective. Maybe sometime with the next Amityville or whatever.
Come and gone.
Yeah, but there will be another. They never stop. If there was a machine I could flick and exercise Amityville film from still coming out, I would do that.
Wait, can you stop some other franchises too? Because...
Yeah, that wouldn't be the first line of attack. I think I'd start with Transformers.
I'd start with Conjuring.
Oh, yes.